Good. It was nice to see you at the party. Been too long.
Let's roll without glasses. What do you say?
Yeah, well, I might have to put them on because I need them not for cosmetic effect, but for seeing.
Oh.
But anyway, it's so good to see you, Mark, and welcome to you and the audience. Pleasure to welcome to the program an old friend of conversations and of the world, I would say. Brilliant fellow, if I may suggest, at the outset, Mark Stallman. He's a, I'm not sure. We've given various titles to him. He's a scholar of the high order and a person that's very concerned with emerging technology. And he's now with the Gartner Group, as I understand, as a strategist. And Mark, welcome very, very much to Conversation. Always good to
Harold,
talk to Mark.
Thank you for inviting me back.
It's my great, good pleasure to do so.
It's great to be here again.
I want to catch up with you because it's been 2 or 3 years since we've talked, and I want to catch up with you. But would you please, for the audience who may be viewing, share a little of your own background, okay? Just an education, a little bit like that, and then we'll get into a discussion of things cyber and technology
sure.
and so forth.
Sure.
And business cycles that...
Business cycles are a big part of the conversation we're going to have today, I think.
Okay, good.
I've been doing technology for about 30 years now, and investments, capital markets, for about 20 years.
Yeah.
So that involves many cycles. Turns out that the technology business operates on roughly a 7-year cycle. Somewhere in the 6 to 8 region, we'll average it out to be about 7.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that I have been fortunate enough to go through 4 or 5 of these cycles.
Yes, I see. Seven-year cycle. That's interesting. They have all kinds of... But share your own background. You were interested in... You coined the term, if I'm not mistaken, Silicon Alley.
Alley, right.
Yeah, Alley here. And you're a new media... I think you brought AOL public. And some of those things, your past experience and so forth, if you could, just briefly.
Sure. I actually started a software company in the 70s,
mm-hmm.
Found my way to Massachusetts and Wang Labs
mm-hmm.
By the end of the 70s, and spent a lot of time in the Middle East, actually.
Didn't know that.
In Saudi Arabia and Bahrain and Kuwait.
This is a part of Saudi Arabia. I didn't even know.
I was invited by the Saudi government to mm-hmm. help them make a standard for Arabic.
Mm-hmm.
That would run on computers.
Mm-hmm.
So by that time in the late 70s, they had not yet standardized how they would represent the Arabic language in computers. Can you believe it?
I don't quite understand what you mean. Fonts and things like that or what? I don't quite understand what you mean.
Coding, actually.
Coding,
Because it's not the same alphabet as
ours. That's right.
It's
not
ours.
The phonetic alphabet. It's not the Phoenician alphabet. And
it uses actually a whole number of diacriticals. There's a variety of ways that it's different.
Yeah.
In addition to being written backwards.
Chinese is different too. They're ideograms. The Chinese language put down ideograms.
Yes.
I think it's different than our
alphabet. But Arabic is alphabetic.
Okay. Yeah.
But it is a slightly different alphabet.
Mm-hmm.
And so deciding what code to assign to each of the letters.
Mm-hmm.
Had to be done to standardize.
So you understand things about coding and the writing of programs and software.
I was a software programmer, coder.
Where'd you get started in that?
I taught myself, actually.
Oh, really? Good.
Yeah.
Autodidactic. Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, good. Okay. And you were always interested in technology. Wasn't your dad involved with...
He was involved with Norbert Wiener.
Norbert Wiener.
Fascinating fellow.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to talk a few biographies here, I think, probably today. A biography recently appeared... of Wiener,
mm-hmm.
Calling him the dark hero of the information age.
Huh, okay.
Wiener did something very strange. He was the founder of cybernetics.
Seems that way. He founded the... Weren't they in a room where your dad was
when they coined the term, a handful of them.
I think it was
a handful of them and a bottle of red wine.
Good wine, I hope, I trust.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay, and it was in what year?
Around 1945.
When they came up with the term cyber.
That's where cyber got into our vocabularies.
Yeah,
comes from Greek.
Yeah,
there's a helmsman, correct?
Helmsman, yeah.
So that's the final closing of the feedback loop.
Yeah.
Between the sail, the boat,
uh-huh.
the ocean, the oar,
yeah.
and then Kybernetes.
Yeah, but you know you have a trim tab too. Mr. Fuller used to talk about when you have the big ocean liners, they have the big thing at the back of the steers. There's a little trim tab. Did you realize, ever hear of that?
No, I haven't.
The little thing on the thing that sets the course for the thing to go in, for the big tiller to move, or for the big guiding blade. Yeah, it's called trim tab. It's just something Fuller used. He used to have a thing called trim tab, and thing estate. But he did that, and he was a scholar, serious scholar, Ptolemy, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
My father, at the recommendation of Norbert Wiener, who was fascinated with genius,
mm-hmm.
he was, by many accounts, a genius himself,
yeah,
Wiener.
Yeah, I would think, yeah.
And he was really interested in how people came up with apparently completely new ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And actually wrestled with the question of whether in some sense they might be remembering something that had been forgotten.
Hmm.
So this was a very important topic in the 50s,
mm-hmm.
when there was a great deal of concern about where we were going and whether, in fact, we might have, in some sense, disappeared into the television screen.
Mm-hmm. Sounds a little bit like Mr. McLuhan, a little bit.
Yeah, there's some McLuhan in there also.
Yeah,
McLuhan,
yeah.
And Wiener never met each other,
didn't
as far
not.
As I can tell,
mm-hmm.
but were working on many of the same problems.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So
the implications of our technological extensions.
Yes.
The medium is the
exactly.
message, Mr.
Exactly.
McLuhan said, and
exactly.
where does it mean, and what is the, how do we read and make sense out of the technologies in terms of consciousness and other socio-political issues?
It turns out, mm-hmm. and it's always funny how this happens,
mm-hmm.
that I wound up working on many of those same problems, and only later discovering
mm-hmm.
my father's involvement with Wiener and the rest of it. So
I
was not brought up to do this.
You were not brought up
was.
On the dinner table.
And,
like
and,
they weren't
and,
talking
in some way.
Uh-huh.
No, it was history of ancient mathematics
mm-hmm.
Around the dinner table, and actually sports cars.
And sports cars.
Sports
That's
cars.
A pretty good combination.
Yeah.
But you had an intellectually stimulating situation with a father that's a real serious scholar and so forth, so you were stimulated intellectually, and you have an autodidactic turn of mind. Educating
yes,
yourself.
Yes, and I think it'd be fair to say that I was a smartass also.
Yeah, smartass. That's all New York City needs is another smartass. Yeah, and also, and then you got very interested in the technology in terms
sure.
of your investment banking with Brown or with a company. What company you were with or you brought?
Sure, the first company on Wall Street I worked for was Sanford Bernstein, and that's probably the most important in terms of shaping my career. And that's
mm.
actually where this story of the seven-year cycles comes from.
Okay.
But just to complete the biography here,
yeah.
before returning to that,
yeah.
I left Sanford Bernstein in 89, went
mm-hmm.
to Alex Brown and
yes,
Sons.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
They were a big investment banker. They've disappeared now after a series of acquisitions and are now a part of Deutsche Bank. But I was the analyst and the banker that brought America Online public. They had only just adopted that name, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
They were Quantum Data Services before that.
Really? I didn't know.
They were
know.
A bulletin board service primarily for Commodore
mm-hmm.
64
Commodore
computers.
Commodore 64, yeah, right.
So they had just decided that they were going to work with Windows
mm-hmm.
and just decided to change their name at the time that they came public in 92.
That was Mr. Chase?
Steve Chase was the head,
yeah,
correct.
Yeah, okay, yeah. right. You did that. And then you did that. And also, I think you were the one in your bio, Sun Microsystems. You recommended earlier than anyone else.
Sun Microsystems came public in 86.
Yeah, but you recommended it earlier.
World,
I understood.
The world was against them,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't know any better.
Fools rush in where angels fear to tread, huh? Yeah.
It turns out that both Sun Microsystems
mm-hmm.
and America Online, two names that were important in my career at least,
yeah, sure.
were both rejects from the same and probably the most important venture capital firm in California. Kleiner Perkins,
mm-hmm. don't know, yeah.
Caulfield okay. and Byfield were actually buyers.
Uh-huh.
KPCB were early investors, could not figure out how to make either of those companies work. Now, of course, Sun Microsystems is a $15 billion a year server vendor, and
yeah.
AOL is a significant part of Time Warner.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
But at that juncture,
uh-huh.
one of the options you had if
mm-hmm.
you were a venture capitalist were...
Which you count yourself? Or did?
I've done that, too,
yeah.
yes. But,
yeah.
but no, I wouldn't call myself a venture capitalist now.
Now you're a strategist.
I'm an analyst. I'm a technology analyst.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. The one option, if you're an investment banker, is to try to find a greater fool.
Mm-hmm.
And the greater fool is often the public. So
okay.
if there is a retail investment house,
mm-hmm.
Alex Brown was, in this case,
mm-hmm.
Baltimore-based, very large retail network, you could take a company that you didn't really think was going to make it, and sell it to the public, and then be very quiet, and take your money away before everything blew up. Both Sun Microsystems and AOL were judged by Kleiner Perkins to be
of that nature.
End cases that needed
end stage.
They needed to be flushed.
And there probably have been many.
There have been many. Yeah. Absolutely many.
The majority of efforts didn't go that way, I suppose, in the realm.
I don't know what the total
guessing, but
final tally will be, but those two stand out, not just because foolishly I decided to become a backer of both of them, but because they have played very important roles in the network economy that is now widespread, in fact, impossible to deny.
Yeah, right. And how did you come to identify them, do you think? Was it a shooting at a dartboard, or was it based on analysis? How did you get interested in the technology and also in the investment banking to the point where you got yourself so involved, when you could have become a professor or something, you know, or something else? What attracted you to that realm?
I think the fact that it pays good money.
Okay, that's one reason. It attracts a lot of people.
Was one of the reasons. I think the fact that it is
challenging intellectually.
It turns out that innovation is a difficult subject. We were talking before about Joseph Schumpeter. Schumpeter is an Austrian economist who made a great deal of this distinction between invention and innovation. Turns out that invention is relatively easy compared to innovation.
Yeah, you spell the difference out. I'm not clear of myself.
Invention is what you would think it to be.
Invention
is coming up with a new idea, a better mousetrap, something that improves on sliced bread. The problem, though, is translating that into something which can actually build an economic momentum and ultimately many businesses around. Innovation requires it's innovation.
Innovation.
It's difficult.
There's not a simpler thing of saying taking good ideas and making them applicable or something. Or application
sure.
in terms of success in cyber.
And
to build a business model, maybe, or to
build a business model, attract financing, and discover markets. This is a very complicated real life activity, and in many ways a challenge to understand.
Well, that's what the financial institutions are about, largely, particularly venture capital ones. They're looking for that kind of thing that's going to be able to give an advantage to whatever investments they want to put their income into. That's what it's all about.
That's what they hope, right?
And the financial decision making process.
That's right.
Financial, business, that sort of thing.
Yes, right.
Mr. Van Gogh never sold a painting. He kept painting those things with good ideas, and they did not. And then they become meaningful in that practical sense of the word.
Right.
When they fetched $35 million at Sotheby's, 100 years after.
Well, those who figured out how to build auction houses and galleries and promote the artists and so
Don't
forth.
Don't forget Thomas Wolfe with the painted word.
Are those who have some hand in the innovation? But it turns out that new technologies, which are always bubbling up from the invention standpoint, only periodically enter in a big way with innovations that really transform the broader economy.
Harold Evans has a book out about those who build America now. It was almost all people who put together a good business model that was able to take an idea and put it into practical application. So is that what you're talking about, really?
Yes, but there is a there's a backdrop to this, which is you've got to know where you are in the cycle. So
the business cycle, let's say.
The business cycle is actually the term that Schumpeter used. His book, published in 1938 while he was at Harvard, called Business Cycles, is really the original Bible of this whole topic. Invention, innovation, business cycles, all united in that one work.
And he also talks about creative entrepreneurialism, creative capitalism, creative...
Creative destruction was the term that became very popular.
Associated with him, yeah.
That was his phrase, correct.
Yeah, and he was that way. Who else is he linked into in terms of the canon, the economic canon? Would he be linked with Van Hayek?
Well, he's Austrian.
Yeah, Austrian.
So people think of him.
Ludwig van Mises, maybe, or something? I'm just trying to think. Is he part of an Austrian school?
He's not.
He's not. He's sort of a very unique and brilliant
fellow. He is a contemporary of Hayek and Mises, but not the same.
Okay.
The simple answer for you is that he faded and has really not been much studied in the last, 50 years.
I think he's very au courant now in a lot of circles. I mean, I think a lot of people are bringing up Mr. Schumpeter, including yourself and an author in Venezuela that you want to talk a lot about.
I think the name is probably dropped more often than there's much care given to studying what the man had to say.
Why would that be?
For instance.
What point is trying to be made by those that drop that name when it's not really having much...
Well, they want to associate themselves with...
With what?
Innovation.
Innovation.
And therefore,
okay.
Riches. So the whole internet sweep of the 90s was peppered with references...
To
creative destruction. To Schumpeter, often by people who hadn't read... His
Schumpeter.
Works.
Yes, right. I see. Yeah. Well, that happens. Yeah.
He got into a battle with Keynes. There's a biography.
Who was very au courant most of that century.
Yeah. There's a biography that has just been published actually earlier this year, in 2007, by a fellow at Harvard, and it's subtitled "Prophet of Innovation."
Okay. Right.
It's a book that I would highly recommend.
Okay. Well, if you recommend it, it's worth taking attention to everybody.
Well, because it really sets his life in a context that it never had before.
Okay.
But for this discussion, the important point is probably that he got in a battle with Keynes and lost.
Okay, go on. Yeah.
And so Keynes emerged, particularly after World War II. The school around Keynes, with Hayek perhaps as the alternative, the Keynesian approach was extremely successful.
Out of the Depression and out of the war.
Largely because it involved governments actually manipulating various economic and monetary policies.
Including necessarily, if necessary, some deficit spending if necessary.
Absolutely.
Yeah, right.
But it was the sort of thing you could build a career on.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, if you were in that era, Mr. Roosevelt and so forth.
Sure.
And remember Mr. Nixon in 1972 famously said, "We're all Keynesians now." He said that in 1972 it had reached a point where Mr. Reagan was just over the horizon and everything. But that, Keynes was huge and set the template for much of the 20th century until Reagan. And what was informing Reagan? And what is it, if he said in 1972 we're all Keynesians now, I would ask you now in 2007, what are we all now?
What is the major
economic theory that informs the political and business process that operates this interrelated spaceship Earth now? Who is it that we are following?
It's still Keynes.
It is still Keynes in your
view? Absolutely.
Okay, fine. Okay.
I mean, there obviously is a tug of war that goes on editorial pages every day with the Wall Street Journal and others proclaiming that we want to have as little government as possible.
Yeah.
They can, of course, say that from the highest to hill. It doesn't change the fact that we have enormous government intervention.
Mm-hmm.
So you might say that Bush's rejection by his own party revolves around the fact that he turned out to be a big government Keynesian also.
Yeah. Well, he spends a lot of money in Iraq, didn't he? Yeah.
And elsewhere. Right?
Yeah.
No vetoes for all those years, all of those earmarks.
Well, they were going to privatize Social Security, and that got to be a little bit big thing to do. And he got so far along that line.
Right.
and was able to do so much, but he's still being, a lot of the right wing is really upset with him for being such a big time spender, isn't he, aren't they?
If Schumpeter was the principal intellectual rival in the late 30s and early 40s with Keynes, and they were literally publishing books, bang, bang, one against the other, and the reviews were going back and forth, the people were taking sides. If we had actually left Keynes, then there would necessarily be a much higher degree of interest in Schumpeter. It hasn't happened.
Whatever happened to Karl Marx?
Ha!
That's sort of on the dustbin of history in years. That socialist, or that idea that the left had in terms of economic theory and so forth.
Yes, I'd say that the fact that nobody could figure out how to actually make it work might have had something to do with that.
And do you think the system that we got in place is able, because you're talking about investing in things and ideas and so forth, we have a capability of provide, let's just say in an abstract sense, we have a capability of providing life support for the people of the world, that in a certain sense we have a capability that our systems are not able to allow us to realize in a full system sense for the whole world. We do not have a system in place in the minds of many that is adequate to what the future requires for a fully effective system of operating this planet in the interest of all people within an ecological context, or do we?
To be sure, many views and many dissenting views continue to ricochet off the walls. I know you have your favorites.
I got my Mr. Kelso. I
absolutely.
Still think he's good, and he's coming on. Bob Ashford is coming back in town. Maybe you could catch up with him
while
he's in town next week.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
What I'm going to promote...
And binary economics,
today,
right.
And I would love to take this up with
Bob
or anyone else, is simply, no matter how you might decide to deal with money, to deal with finance, banking, government intervention, all of those potential levers. Sweep all that aside. Ignore all that for the moment.
Okay.
And ask yourself the question, what is really the underlying motive force, the engine that drives innovation and therefore real economic growth? Therefore, I would suggest a conversation about Schumpeter would be very much in order. Now, as Schumpeter came sort of into the headlines in the 90s, but wasn't really paid much attention to.
Yeah, a lot of those people would bring him up, as a role.
We have gone through, to return to the topic of seven-year cycles, we clearly had a
boom.
Crash, boom, bang,
in 2000.
In 2000, right? So this is the combination...
Hell of a way to start a millennium, huh?
Of... the Y2K phenomenon, which was massive.
Yeah,
obviously, the internet bubble, and let's throw in a little religious millenarianism on top of that.
Okay.
End of the world.
Yeah, right.
Throw all that in together, stir it all up, and put a match to it.
Right.
We have, therefore, here we are in 2007, and I've been telling you.
Yeah,
we work in roughly seven-year cycles.
Yeah, I heard you
in
say
this.
That. Yeah.
That means that we have just completed whatever
cycle began in 2000.
We got from 2000.
Right. Okay. That's in which seven-year cycle? Okay. Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah.
Which was the compensation? Which was the penance? It was the hangover. It was the day after, and then the year, and the multiple years after the excesses of the 90s. We've balanced it all out now. We now have a chance to start again. So we are at the beginning of another upcycle.
Really?
Precisely.
Okay.
Right.
Interesting. Yeah, okay, you think that, right?
I'm quite sure of it. And I think this is actually now showing up.
How do you come up with 7 years? I did programming quite a bit. He came and stayed with me, that kind of thing, with Robbie Batra. He had a thing, he had a book, do you remember it? He had he had a 30-year cycle. And there's a thing to see 30-year cycles. Ravi Batra had the book, The Great Depression of 1990, and other books. And he was serious. He was a serious writer. And Lewis looked at it, and it was a 30-year cycle where you could see mostly it was almost generational. How do you come up with the 7-year cycle? Where do you get the 7 years?
I think they're probably
not the 17-year cicada, but
yeah,
how
there,
do you
there
up
are
with
probably
it?
Two ways that people come up with
the 7 year.
Any accounting.
Well,
Batra
took it back through all of history and said that it, you know,
it's
generational.
That tends towards a kind of numerological or possibly even religious belief in the appropriateness of numbers. As you
stretch,
you stretch way beyond what you have been able to
quantify,
measure,
and
count,
mm-hmm.
then you have probably gone over into the realm of numerology, and that's a danger, I think, in any of these cyclical approaches.
Well, on the basis of what do we get? Are we dealing just with numbers, or are we dealing with things sociological, economic, political, these kind of things in terms of the seven-year thing?
It starts from the numbers.
Yeah, okay.
And so in my particular case, mm-hmm. while I was at Sanford Bernstein in the 80s, I was actually the fellow that ran the firm, mm-hmm. came in my office one day, and he said, Stallman, I've got a job for you.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that there's something about technology which is wrong. It doesn't fit.
About technology.
As an investor. So he's speaking as an investor and saying...
What year are you talking about now? What year are you talking about? Roughly, can you...
Roughly 86, 87.
86, 87. Okay. Yeah.
So he had a multi-billion dollar portfolio that he was running, and he was investing in all range of possible companies. So he had a very keen sense of the... Of the way that financial institutions or automobile companies or pharmaceutical companies, how they tended to move in relationship to broader economic moves,
mm-hmm.
positive and negative. And he said technology stands out. It is different. It doesn't work.
And by that he meant information technology that you're talking about.
He meant computers. Increasingly, networks were involved. But at that point, it was companies like Digital Equipment and Data General, IBM.
All the information that was coming. McLuhan used to say technology is an extension of consciousness. In fact, technology is the extension of our capability and environment to make the thing. So it involves steel mills and automobiles. It's all an extension of our consciousness.
Right.
It's all technology, but information technology.
We're talking here about information technology.
There's a distinct quality to it.
Absolutely.
Okay, so
information
you're talking
technology
about 7 years.
As a set of investment opportunities at that point in the late 80s didn't fit. And he gave me the assignment to try to figure out why.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And in order to do that, I took all of the available financial information for all of the companies that mattered, a big pile of annual reports.
That'd be a hell of a lot of data.
Turns out,
hope you had a good computer. Super gray, I hope.
Turns out that there were around 2,000 quarterly reports I had to go through.
Wow.
And...
Yeah. That represents 2,000 entities, 2,000 corporate entities?
No, it actually...
Industries, or what?
It actually was about, because there are four quarters per year.
Yeah, yeah.
And I took about 10 years with the history, so that's 400 quarters, times about 50.
50 companies.
50 companies, yeah.
Okay, and you selected those as the ones that mattered in terms of this thing you were trying to track?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I guess that's what it's about, really, is being able to do that. Computers could help and modeling could help, I would think, you know.
And they did. And they did.
Right.
So I poured over this and...
Almost have to be used.
I wound up, I didn't start this way, but I wound up asking the question because it began to be clear as I was analyzing the data that there was a pattern of rapid growth and then... leveling off, and rapid growth and leveling off, and I was trying to figure out how this actually sorted out.
Rapiding off, and
there would be a new phenomenon. Along comes a new phenomenon.
But the trend was up, right?
The overall trend is up,
yeah.
But that upward trend is composed of a series of smaller trends.
Plateaus, yeah.
And those smaller trends involve periods of slow growth and then rapid growth, followed by slow growth, followed by rapid growth.
And it's not followed by a decrease. Everything's growth. It's all growth. It's all uphill. There's nothing downhill. Ever go down.
Until
there was 29, remember.
That was 2000.
Yeah. No, 1929.
1929 was 2000.
What do you mean? Oh, I see what you're getting. I think I see what you're
the
getting.
The crash.
Yeah, right. Okay, right.
29, and this is exactly...
For industrial era.
Exactly the point.
Yeah.
In a previous long wave...
Yeah, long wave. Yeah,
which
yeah.
are roughly 60 years in length.
Oh, okay, thank you, yeah.
All right, so we're back to...
Batra, yeah.
We're back actually to the business cycle.
Right.
As Schumpeter described it.
Uh-huh.
And many others, by the way. So in the 30s, this was a very popular topic, as
yeah.
you can imagine.
Yeah.
So we're coming... through, but not yet out of the Depression. Mm-hmm. Everybody's trying to figure out, when is this going to be over?
Mm-hmm.
How do we get into this mess?
How in the hell do we avoid getting into it again?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
The biggest question has been on the minds of the 20th century in many instances.
Absolutely. So, yeah. Keynes's answer to that was, you've got to grab the levers of the economy and you have to manipulate through government and other institutions.
Mm-hmm.
Schumpeter's answer to that question was, you have to innovate
mm-hmm.
your way out of these problems.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it turns out that those cycles of innovation
mm-hmm.
in the information technology era, which is the only one that I've studied,
mm-hmm.
are roughly 7 years in length.
I see. In the information technology.
Correct.
When do we begin this information age, would you say? That with
begin it?
Yeah, when does it begin? It's relatively new in terms of the larger sweep of human history.
In the early 70s.
Early 70s, so you're talking about beginning in the early 70s.
Correct.
7 years. Could we use 70 as a basic beginning point?
70, 72, 77? It turns out to be a somewhat better year because it all comes back to a particular technology,
mm-hmm.
which is the one that we now refer to based on Moore's Law and mm-hmm. so forth, the integrated circuit.
Mm-hmm.
So we had transistors going back to the 40s.
We were at the time when we didn't have transistors, you know? And they couldn't predict ahead, what was going to come. Somebody invented it down, I don't know where, and then,
when we finally came to the point where we could integrate very large numbers of transistors.
Yeah, right, integrated circuits.
The integrated circuit,
the
basis of all the equipment that surrounds us.
Right here in the studio.
Everything that anyone who's watching the show.
And the trends they're in.
Absolutely.
Because we're coming up to carbon 60, and we're coming up to molecular computing, I believe. I mean, you would know this more than I, but they're going to get beyond Moore's Law when they get to molecular computing, as I understand it.
We probably have another 20 years or
that
so
long
before that happens. So
of Moore's Law.
At least.
Silicon.
I absolutely.
Even though they're down to atomic size almost now, it seems.
Absolutely. We have another 25 years.
No integrated circuit could ever be made by a human being, could it? It's too intricate and too carefully done, and it's all extended technological.
Correct.
Capability.
Correct. But it is the integrated circuit, which is at the center of a larger complex of technologies responsible for the 60-year economic cycle we are now living in.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So our lives, uh-huh. our children's and our grandchildren's lives, uh-huh. all intersect this
uh-huh.
cycle at some point.
How does
so my father...
Yeah. In 45 or 48.
Born in the 20s, was entering into the cycle before the integrated circuit cycle, which was based on oil, by the way.
What was based on oil? The integrated
cycle was an oil-based cycle. So his life stretched over and overlapped into... And every one of us has to line up.
When did that begin? Did that begin in Pennsylvania with Mr. Rockefeller and so forth? When did that begin, that era? That era that we were coming out of?
Around the turn of the century.
Around the turn of the
century. Around 1900, correct.
Okay, and it was there. Okay, and a 70-year cycle takes us to 1970, doesn't it?
It does, and then in that particular cycle, because we had this really extended crisis, of nearly 10 years, it sort of stretched things out, which is an important point, which is to say you cannot be numerological. You can't be superstitious about the precise pattern.
Mm-hmm.
You can't say because this is this particular year, this particular month, this should happen.
Yeah, I know. People would like to try and do that if they could.
Many would.
I would if I could, wouldn't you? Yeah, take it to the bank. Yeah, yeah. But to understand
all you really can do from collecting the numbers and trying to analyze the patterns is to notice sort of an overall tendency. There's an enormous amount of variability, an enormous amount of individual activity necessary. Because none of it is predestined.
Yeah, okay. And there are variations in that, and things will happen that will affect the individual and so on, but there are patterns, and then there are also trends. And the trends, is there any speed up in the trend of things?
I mean, there isn't, and this is very important.
That's interesting.
It's very important.
Yeah.
And there are many people who believe that there is, but I would disagree. And the reason for
this,
from the data.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you ask me to explain the data, I would come right back to what you said earlier, which is it winds up being a sociological and economic phenomenon.
Okay.
In other words, if you today's information technology industry probably at its heart involves 10 million people.
Okay. If you say you would know.
Out of the world's population.
Yeah, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Where are we at now? 6 billion?
6.5, I think. Yeah. Oh. Heading for 10, they tell us, at the UN.
Okay.
Around 2020.
But all 6 billion people are not every day driving this information technology industry.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just arbitrarily say it's around 10 million people.
Okay. Yeah, all right.
These 10 million people are independent operators.
Mm-hmm.
They don't get told what to do.
Mm-hmm.
They get up every morning and make their minds up.
Yeah.
And
a lot of entrepreneurialism there.
Absolutely.
That's Mr. Schumpeter. Yeah.
There's a great deal of people who are working for themselves or small companies in the midst of this. There are certainly large companies, so the IBMs and others have hundreds of thousands of employees, but nobody's got millions of employees. So it's.
I guess that's true. I hadn't thought, but it is.
Right.
You gave me that great thing about autonomic computing, which I still use, and it's still up on the IBM research page. Yeah,
absolutely. Still quite important. Actually, becoming more important all the time.
Mm.
So, this population of 10 million people, let's say, spread around the world, in order for it to act in a unified fashion, have to coordinate somehow, or they have to all decide to more or less do the same thing.
Or be in touch with their peers or their colleagues or whatever, or
what's
going on. Yeah.
Left to their own devices, they're going to be fairly random. So the Internet is a fine example.
Okay.
If, by and large, all those people hadn't decided that they were together going to work on the Internet, work on their various pieces and projects, but tie it all together, then it wouldn't have happened.
It took some people that made...
So coordinating a large number of people is obviously a sociological and economic problem.
Yeah. Political? No. Political?
Not really so much. Not really so much.
Okay.
Psychological, perhaps.
Yeah.
But the point is it can't be done instantaneously.
Okay.
It takes a while for everybody to figure out, I understand, this is what's working now. And to all become coordinated. So, for example, in New York, you mentioned Silicon Alley before. There was an organization.
You coined the term.
I coined that term, but I helped to form an organization called the New York New Media Association.
Yeah.
NYMA, it is no more. But in its day, it was able to attract 5,000-6,000 people in New York for a party on a Friday night.
That's pretty good. 5,000 or 6,000.
That's a lot. That's a lot of people.
That high charge,
boogieing to the same beat.
Yeah, right.
Now, I happen to know, because I started that party in my own living room, that getting a dozen people together in 92 was a chore. Getting a dozen people to come together to talk about and then coordinate their activities about this internet thing.
Is that the non-linear entity or non-linear?
That actually came a bit later. But
So what was the difference? I don't know. What's the difference?
From 92, the year when AOL came public, when I started a salon, we called it the Cyber Salon, when we were trying to organize small groups of people, to 94. four or five when you could get 5,000 people together.
Oh, I see, yeah.
Everybody got the idea.
Uh-huh. It just was a happening.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, by 96 and 7, they got overexcited and overexuberant about the possibilities and drove right off the cliff, as we say, without any skid marks.
Like lemmings.
Right. So by 2000, we were back to a state of confusion. As the market collapsed, as what everybody convinced themselves had to happen didn't.
You're talking Y2K, or you're
talking the whole collection of events around 2000.
A lot of things still remain. The internet's still there and everything. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the in 2001, 2002, 2003, nobody could come up with a new idea. Everybody was basically banging their heads against the wall.
Panting. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And then along came this whole outsourcing idea. So by 2003, 2004, there was a remarkable congruence, a coordinated judgment that now
targeted Bangalore.
The interest is
and India,
elsewhere,
yeah.
And we're going to arbitrage our labor rates. We're going to outsource many of these processes.
But weren't there global patterns in effect before that, and people in the know would have been taking knowledge of the fact that the internet was in fact global, and there were all these global forces that were part of it?
I would say in the 99-2000 time period, what became common wisdom in 2003-2004 was very rare,
yeah.
Very unusual.
They didn't see the outsourcing coming.
No, didn't see it coming.
Uh-huh.
Now, by the way, that's run its course.
Okay, talk to me about that, because a lot of people are still talking about it. Yeah.
So just as
just as
the excitement in the mid-90s about this new internet thing ran its course and overran, actually, its possibilities, the outsourcing opportunities of 2003 and 4 ran their course. We are now at the point where wage rates in India for many of these outsourcing firms are coming up to parity with the U.S. We're now at the point...
Is that a fact? Yeah?
It is a fact.
Yeah. All right.
We're now at the point where...
Can China undercut them then or something, or some other place undercut those and...
That's very advantageous if you speak English.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, that was the old Raj, Raj
exactly,
blend. Yeah,
exactly.
Right.
So
yeah.
We are now at the point where the outflow of manufacturing has begun to reverse, and manufacturing is coming back to the U.S.
Is that a fact?
It is a fact.
I saw that somewhere in a thing, and I couldn't quite understand it.
It is a fact.
Yeah. Is that because of the advantage of the lower wages that were perceived in the outsourcing and so forth, they're finding not to be so effective, or are so much a part of the picture because wages are going up?
It turns out that transportation costs become quite important.
I would have thought they would to go across an ocean. It must take a lot of transportation costs.
It takes a lot of oil.
Yes, that's right. And $90 a barrel.
So as the price of oil goes up, the cost of transporting things across the oceans
go
up.
Yeah.
But there's also a greater sense of local manufacture, a greater sense of local supply. Some of it is probably national security related. Some of it has to do with pools of talent and where these people reside. But the net of it is that massive outflow that got everybody's attention for a while.
The outsourcing wave
has clearly crested.
Really?
And in some respects, is actually reversing.
And they're actually coming back manufacturing to the United States of America?
Yes.
Is that a fact?
I had dinner.
Where?
I don't have statistics.
Oh, all right.
But I have anecdote.
Okay.
So
well, anecdotes will be followed by statistics soon, right?
Yeah. Had dinner a couple months ago in Dallas.
All right.
With a colleague I work with and one of his best friends who happened to be in town. And the dinner all revolved around the friend's job as a recruiter for a major headhunting firm. And his business and increasing the business of the headhunting firm was to hire manufacturing executives in the U.S.
No fooling. Huh. Well, that's anecdotal. Runs counter to the perception a lot of people have about the way things are going.
Right.
Big deficit to the country of China that's doing an awful lot of exporting of their materials over here. Right. At least it seemed this Christmas everything you buy was made in China. It seems that way, but you're saying that is now being reversed and the manufacturing industries are coming home to roost?
Yeah.
Coming back to the North America, Europe?
Most European manufacturers and Japanese manufacturers have U.S.-based auto plants. So there are many ways I think this could be identified. But the primary point that I'm making is that the seven-year cycle involves the coordination of large groups of people around a common idea.
Right.
They get mobilized. They all wind up trying to accomplish the same thing. They ultimately fill that market up, saturate the opportunities, then growth rate slows down, they start scratching their head, they start wondering what's next, the things become relatively random once again, and so this process of organizing and then breaking down and disorganizing and then reorganizing large groups of people, I believe, is the sociological and economic reason behind the data that I collected.
I see.
I'm not a sociologist or economist, but to try to give an explanation for the data.
I just read an interesting book by Dorian Sagan and Lynn Margulis on evolution. I bet you could find biological analogs to the kind of thing in terms of the way evolution itself is compiled. Is going. It's just a thought that came into my head as I'm sitting here talking to you. You can find the way, the whole biological evolutionary process and so forth is there. But I mean, you got that kind of, you've got that kind of
This is already beginning to show up in many of the technology companies that I follow results.
Okay.
Famously, August, actually, of this year, a few months ago, Cisco is run by a fellow named John Chambers. Chambers is probably the most closely followed individual whose pronouncements about the information technology industry are taken to be almost gospel.
Who was the guy, Bill Joy? Who was it, his son? Was his son, Bill Joy?
Bill Joy was a famous engineer at Sun. Scott McNeely was the fellow that ran the company. So Scott McNeely, CEO's and chairman's equivalent at Cisco,
I think,
is,
I probably
touched
on Joe because he was somebody who was reading the implications of it in terms of a larger understanding of what the philosophical implications are necessary.
That would be Bill's job, not Scott's job.
Right.
And in this case, John Chambers' job is to get up four times a year when the company reports its quarterly results.
Right.
They close their quarter, in this instance, in July. So they finish their business in July, so roughly 2 weeks later, second week in August, Chambers presides over an hour-long conference call. Every company does their conference calls, and some of them are more attended to than others. This one got everyone's attention because John Chambers launched off into a speech about how we were just now beginning to enter the second phase of the Internet.
Oh, okay, that's interesting. When was that? What's the date?
I'm going to say it was August 15th.
This year.
It was right around the middle of August. Cisco's well organized, and they tend to be one of the first to report.
Okay, yeah, right. That's good. So that's the beginning of a new cycle.
That was his declaration. I didn't talk to him about it.
Right.
We didn't coordinate that view.
Right. It just came up.
It just came out based
you were finding.
Based upon the business conditions that he sees. But it is now being repeated at Hewlett-Packard.
So the herd is getting ready to move in a new direction. Okay, that's
exactly right.
Listen, we got about 10 minutes left, and we don't want to get away from the fact there's a woman down in Venezuela that you're very taken with. And if you don't mind, we're talking Shumpeter and that kind of stuff. And she's somebody that seems to have a wide following and that sort of thing. And maybe you could fill her in her name, the book, and what she's saying and how it fits in. You think she's a major contribution philosophically to understanding
it's exactly the problem we've already discussed.
Mm-hmm.
With Schumpeter's defeat
mm-hmm.
and therefore disappearance, you would kind of wonder, is anybody going to revive this line of inquiry and add to it? And she has.
Okay.
So there is a group of scholars based in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
There is no equivalent in the US that I know of.
Really?
So there's not a group at Harvard or Stanford or Chicago who are working on this problem.
Mm-hmm.
This is a group that is at Cambridge mm-hmm. And Sussex and a few other schools in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
Her name is Carlotta Perez. She is Venezuelan mm-hmm. by birth.
Yeah, okay.
Actually trained in New York, though. She went to Pratt. Of all
here
things.
In New York?
Here in New York.
I'll be damned. Okay.
That was her undergraduate
And then
degree.
She did work in what? In what?
She's well, she's... she touches on many fields.
Right.
She does not call herself an economist, nor a historian. I think of her as the inheritor of Schumpeter's
work. Wow, that's really big.
Work.
Yeah, really, that
and
is
she,
big, yeah.
She published in paperback in 2003 a work that I wanted to mention, which is called Technological Revolutions
mm-hmm.
and Financial Capital.
Right.
And so it's the combination.
You call it a masterwork.
This is where the whole question of innovation
uh-huh.
and its relationship to broader changes uh-huh. in economic history is brought alive.
And what trends there might be and right. cycles there might be that can
right.
be identified.
Because obviously, mm-hmm. published in 2003,
yeah.
it comes after 2000.
Yes.
So this is the only work in that tradition, the mm-hmm. Schumpeter tradition,
mm-hmm.
that tries to take into account the experience that we are having now.
Huh.
In particular, the experience of the internet, the 90s, the collapse,
uh-huh.
and her very strong and correct, I think, assertion that what tends to happen in the middle of these 60-year cycles uh-huh. is this interruption.
Uh-huh.
You wind up having this crash phenomenon.
Uh-huh.
That crash phenomenon precedes a golden age.
Uh-huh.
In fact,
uh-huh.
the subtitle of the book it's about bubbles
uh-huh.
and golden ages.
Bubbles and golden ages.
Golden ages.
Okay.
So
yeah.
we have all lived through a bubble.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And we are now living in the beginning of a golden age.
Okay, you feel that. And that's what she's predicting in a certain sense? And there's a group in England. Is she writing more on that? Is there a website? Is there a...
She has a personal website,
okay.
CarlottaPerez.org.
Okay.
She does continue to write and consult. There is, hope, another book in the works.
Uh-huh. Have you been in touch with her? Have you visited with
oh,
her?
Oh, yes, I have.
Been there?
Oh, yeah.
You've visited with her in England and that sort
Actually,
of thing?
Actually, we've spent some time together in New York. I'm going to travel a lot next year. I hope to get over there to see her.
Okay, that would be good. And you think she's somebody really we should be paying attention to in terms of trying to understand what's going on in terms of technology and its development and so forth, right?
Yes.
Imagine your voice.
Back to the theme.
In the tradition of Mr. Schumpeter.
Right. Back to the theme mm-hmm. of genius.
Okay, yeah.
Where,
well, we began with your dad.
Where the assignment my father got from Norbert Wiener
mm-hmm.
to investigate the apparent genius Ptolemy.
Uh-huh. Yeah, talk about cycles, yeah.
Who had somehow recovered, mm-hmm. remembered
uh-huh.
what had otherwise been forgotten
uh-huh.
In a smaller, mm-hmm. Not so grand sense.
Mm-hmm.
Schumpeter has been forgotten.
He needs
to be remembered.
Revived.
Needs
yeah.
to be recalled.
Yeah, he's a major voice. I mean, major voice in terms of economic theory, and so it seems to me.
Absolutely.
Yeah, he's been there.
Theory and actually the practice of beginning the field of counting things, mm-hmm. econometrics.
Yeah.
He contributed to.
Did he really?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. I didn't realize that, but
right.
Well, that's it. And you come down on the bottom that you think we're in an age as technology and information technology is that an age of a golden expansion? Is that
we
what
are.
You're in?
Google is the company that is the most obvious representation of this.
Uh-huh.
We're heading into I would say if outsourcing was the description of the cycle that's behind us now, cloud computing is what Google does.
Cloud, what does that mean?
That means that they have built a massive cloud infrastructure. Yeah. Cloud is just the name that we technologists call.
Oh, I hadn't heard this. That. Yes, that means it sort of takes in everything.
They have millions.
It's comprehensive.
They have millions.
Terabyte. We start talking about terabytes.
Well, we're now talking about millions of individual computers.
Yeah, right. Okay, yeah.
They have today, I would estimate, around 6 million individual computers, and will cross the 10 million point probably by next spring.
My Lord. Google, you're talking
Correct.
About?
Correct. One company.
It's a behemoth.
It is absolutely the largest collection of resources and information about us.
Yeah.
Among other things.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
That anyone has ever put together.
Yeah. Are you optimistic for the human prospect?
Absolutely.
You are. You're absolutely, unequivocally
absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. You're not concerned about God or Ramadan or anything that might come down. You don't think, I am an optimist.
Unlike McLuhan, who was very clear when asked that question. You remember his answer?
I don't remember. No. Whether it was optimistic, I don't remember what his answer was exactly.
When asked if he was an optimist or pessimist, his answer was neither. Mm-hmm. I am an apocalypsist.
Apocalyptic.
And what he meant by that was his job was to reveal and not to be in favor or against or project his own personality or his own feelings into the matter.
He just did probes.
Correct.
And trying to understand.
I'm different from that. I'm an optimist.
You are an optimist and you don't think there's any... Okay, very good. That's very glad to hear that. I'm not so sure myself, but I really that's really good. You're doing that. And do you think then that... do you have some recommendations for the way things are going to develop? What's going to happen at the political level? Do you want to make any observations about how it's going to affect the political process and what's going to happen in terms of confrontation with Islam, confrontation between forces that seem to have a very low esteem of the Western world and the United States, that kind of thing, widespread? Iraq, what's going to happen
well,
there?
Let's I don't want to answer that question directly, but maybe...
You don't think there's any chance there's going to be an atomic unleashing of destructive capability?
Of course, you do think that? Of course, there's a chance.
Do you agree with the things that Kaku and others do by modeling? We do things in terms of capability by modeling that there are weapon systems that exist that, were they to be unreleased, would mean the end of the species? Do you think that's a true fact, or is that just something that is not true to what is the new ontological reality?
I don't know enough about the end of the species, but there certainly are weapon
Kaku
systems.
Kaku says we could.
It happened
around 1970. You're talking about cycles. If there are
weapons systems that could end the species, they're not nuclear.
Well, no, not so. Yeah, but
maybe biological.
Yeah, it does that. But it brings.
But here's a prediction.
But that's an ontologic new reality that exists. But you don't think there's any chance that would be a negative scenario.
You lived through little more than I.
Quite a bit more, unfortunately.
The 50s and that era where the